Chapter 10, second lecture on international trade and finance. So we just saw a video on the difference between comparative advantage and absolute advantage. Before we actually get into the slides, picking up where we left off, let me repeat what she was saying on this video. Say, true or false, in order for a country to maximize its welfare, it ought to produce those things that it is best at producing.
True.
Well, you would think that was true. It's sounds like it would be true, but it's not necessarily true. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say that Americans were better off than anyone else in the world making handmade wicker baskets. So that would mean that we have an absolute advantage in making wicker baskets, and we can do it better than anyone else. So does that mean that we ought to devote our time and energy to making wicker baskets? So you got to ask yourself, if we did devote time to making wicker baskets, what is our opportunity cost? Anybody? Other things would be making, and because we are an advanced industrial country, correct? What kinds of things would we be? In other words, we can't spend an hour making a basket and at the same hour doing something else, correct? Now, for a country like America that's technologically advanced, we'd be better off spending our time in the high-tech field, correct? So in other words, if we devote our time to making wicker baskets, our opportunity costs would be very high. Now, the law of comparative advantage says that a country can maximize its welfare if it produces those things whereby it has low opportunity cost or where it has a comparative advantage. See, not necessarily an absolute advantage. It's a very important concept in economics. So much of economics involves a decision-making process. Should we do this or should we do that? Which activity would we be maximizing our welfare? So a very important concept in making these decisions is the concept of opportunity cost, and in this case, how it applies to comparative advantage. Now, we're applying this to international trade, although you could apply it to things nationally. But the point here is that all countries trade amongst one another. And countries are better off by trading. So then the next question is, if that's true, what should countries specialize in? And the answer to that question is, each country should specialize in those goods and services that it has a comparative advantage, meaning that those activities, those pursuits have low opportunity costs. Okay, well, let's get to these slides. I've got quite a few here. So what we're talking here about is what determines values of countries' currencies. And what we talked about last time is that major currencies in the world, their values are determined by market forces, meaning demand and supply. And we call that floating. We say, these currencies are allowed to float. Now, some currencies are pegged to a major currency. So the value of the major currency goes up, then the value of a secondary currency will go up, and vice versa. But here's a picture of the demand and supply of a currency. And what we talked about last time is, why people would demand a currency. Now, of course, people demand a currency because it's useful and it has value because it's relatively scarce. So here we have the demand for currencies. Here we have the supply for currencies. And it's the interaction between demand and supply that determine the value of that currency on the international market, meaning the equilibrium was where the quantity demanded equals the quantity supplied. So if demand were to increase, you see, the value would go up. And if the demand for that currency would go down, then the value would go down. Supply also affects currencies. Supply decreases on the world market, the value goes up. And if supply increases on the world market, the value goes down. Now, lately, Japan has been taking action to increase the supply of the yen on the world market for the purpose of lowering the value of the yen. And it has decreased in value quite a bit relative to other major currencies. Now, why does a country like Japan want the value of its currency to go down? Remember we talked about this last time? Anybody? Why does a country want the value of its currency to go down? Because when the currency goes down in value, then its goods and services become less expensive to foreigners. Because if a country's currency devalues relative to other currencies, then that means that other currencies are now more valuable relative to, for example, the Japanese yen. And therefore, Japanese products become less expensive to foreigners. When they take dollars and exchange them for yen and to buy Japanese products, well, they can buy more Japanese products because the buying power of the dollar has increased relative to the yen. So money, therefore, flows into Japan, jobs are generated in Japan, and that will bring about more economic growth. So what is it called when countries compete against one another in terms of trying everything they can to lower the value of their currencies? Well, we call that a currency war. A currency war. One nation will do what it can to lower the value of its currency, but then in turn that hurts other countries, so those other countries in retaliation will take action to lower the value of their currencies, etc. Now, one of the main ways to affect the value of a country's currency, because remember, the value of currencies, at least the major currencies, are determined by market forces. So how do countries influence the value of their currencies? Well, they influence those market forces. So if a country engages in quantitative easing, now what does quantitative easing mean? Anybody know that? Quantitative easing is when a country creates money and then puts it into circulation. So if Japan creates yen and puts those yen into circulation, what happens to the supply of yen on the world market? Well, like this graph shows us, supply increases. When the supply increases, what happens? The price or the value of the yen goes down. And that's what is called a dirty float. You know, when countries take action to influence the value of their currencies, then we call that a dirty float. So what is a managed float system? An exchange rate system that combines features of a freely flexible rates with intervention by central banks. So that the system that we are under is called a managed float system. That we say, okay, currencies are allowed to float, meaning that their values are determined by market forces, but we're going to influence those market forces, or we're going to manage those market forces. So we call it a managed float system. And what is the balance of trade? The measure of money that enters and leaves a country via trade with other nations. Now, there's two terms here. One term is balance of trade. The other term is balance of payments. Balance of trade measures flows of money in and out of a country via trade. So if more money is coming into the country via trade, we call that a favorable trade balance. If more money is going out of the country then we call that an unfavorable trade balance or a trade deficit. There's a trade surplus and trade deficits. Trade surplus, more money's coming in via trade. Trade deficit, more money's going out of the country via trade. Now, can money come into a country or exit a country other than trade? Well, there are other ways that money can enter a country or leave a country other than trade. For example, when we travel to foreign countries, American dollars leaves. When foreigners travel here, then money enters the country. Or when we invest in foreign companies or real estate, money goes out. When foreigners invest in American companies or real estate, money comes in. So money can leave a country or enter a country other than trade. And we call that total flow of money in and out the balance of payments. So the balance of payments includes the balance of trade. Okay? Now, what is the problem? What is the problem when too much money leaves the country, or we have a very unfavorable balance of payments over a period of time? What problem would you think that would generate? Anybody?
Unemployment.
Unemployment, exactly. Right? With more money leaves, more money leaves, more money leaves. Well, people have less money to spend, less money to spend, less money to spend. Demand goes down, business sells less, and we get unemployment. Now, what could the problem be if too much money enters the country?
Inflation.
Inflation, right? What causes inflation? Hey, you're doing a good job over there. What causes inflation? Too much money chasing too few goods. So how can we have too much money chasing too few goods? Well, we can have a lot more money coming into the country from, you know, foreign countries. So either extreme is bad. But now what I'm going to explain to you is that there's a natural mechanism. The market will correct any imbalances in terms of balance of payments. Okay, and here's how the reason goes. Okay, let's take one extreme and then the other. Let's say that we have too much money leaving the country. Now, as we just said, that could be a problem in time of unemployment, correct? Now, if too much money is leaving the country, what's going to happen to the supply of that currency on the world market? Okay, yeah. Yeah, thanks for telling me. Yeah. So, all right, we got too much money leaving. The supply of the currency increases on the world market. Okay? Therefore, what's going to happen to the value of that currency?
It's going to decrease.
It's going to decrease. Now, if the value decreases, all right, then what happens to our ability to buy from foreigners? Like, let's say it's a dollar. You know, too many dollars are going into foreign countries. Supply increases, the value of the dollar goes down. What happens to our buying power as Americans when we buy from foreigners?
It goes down.
It goes down, therefore we buy less. Less money, therefore, leaves. Now, if the dollar goes down in value relative to other currencies, what happens to their buying power when they want to buy, when foreigners want to buy American products? See, if the dollar has gone down in value relative to these other currencies, then the flip side of the coin means that these other currencies now have revalued or now have more value relative to the dollar. So as our buying power goes down to buy foreign products, what happens to foreigners' buying power when they want to buy American products? It goes up, right? If their currencies are worth more relative to our currency, then they're going to our products become less expensive to those foreigners. They, therefore, will buy more American products. Now, remember where we started this analysis? We started this analysis by saying that we've got too much money leaving the country. But what happened? Supply increased. The value went down. Less money left. More money entered. So what happened to this problem that we used to have of too much money leaving the country? It's reversed, right? See, the natural process, the market, has turned things around whereby instead of too much money leaving, more money started to come into the country. Now, let's take the other extreme. Let's say that we've got a problem of too much money coming in. And we said that was a problem because that could generate inflation. But if dollars are leaving the world market, what's happened to the supply of dollars on the world market? It's going down. Therefore, what happens to the value of the dollar on the world market? It goes up. When the value goes up, our buying power as Americans, when we buy foreign products, increases. So we buy more foreign products, more money therefore leaves, but foreigners, see, they're going to buy more American products because their values have increased, so the whole problem is solved. See, the problem was too much money was coming in. But because of the changes in the value of the dollar relative to other currencies, the whole process was reversed. Okay, less money was coming in, more money was going out, and we no longer have this problem. So it's an never-ending story. You know, nothing ever stands still in life. And so what happens is the country's currencies are constantly changing, but the market is always tending toward an equilibrium, where the quantity demanded equals the quantity supplied, or the amount of money leaving the country equals the amount of money entering the country. See, that's long-run equilibrium. And notice that all this is taking place without anybody doing anything. We don't have any government here doing anything. It's simply the market at work. Okay? Good example of how free markets work. Well, I don't know where I am now on these slides. Payment surplus means more money's coming in. What can a payment surplus be a problem? You know, we've talked about all this. Payments deficit, more money going out. What can payments deficit, and let's say, at what point is equilibrium reached? When the amount of money entering a country equals the amount of money leaving the country. How are balance of payments problems resolved? Well, something happened to this slide. This is what I just talked about. So I really got ahead of myself here. Why is there a balance in the balance of payments? The value of a country's currency fluctuates as supply fluctuates on the world market. Now, what is, before I leave this, what has propped up the value of the dollar on the world market more than anything else? Something we talked about last time. Why is the American dollar as valuable as it is? And because it has a relatively high value, our buying power as Americans, when we buy foreign products, is very good. You know, we can buy with the American dollar being relatively strong. You know, we can buy foreign products on the cheap because when we exchange our currency for their currencies, we get a lot of their currencies back because our value is high relative to these other currencies. But what's the major reason that that's true? I mean, what's the major reason that the American dollar is has remained strong despite all of our economic missteps? Anybody? The only reason is because the dollar is a world standard currency. Or another way of putting it is the dollar is the world's reserve currency. That means that when other nations want to trade amongst one another, Instead of using their own currencies, they convert their currencies to dollars, and then they trade amongst one another. Okay. See what? Well, I talk about how this all came about here in just a little bit. What happened? What would happen if the dollar fell from its perch of being the world standard currency? What would happen if more and more countries bypassed the dollar and found other ways to trade with nations? What would happen to the value of the dollar? Well, the demand for the dollar would go down in that case. Therefore, the value of the dollar would go down. And if the value of the dollar goes down on the world market, see, we're talking here always about the world market, not just, you know, our own market in the United States. We're talking about the world market. But if the value goes down on the world market, then what happens to us Americans? Well, what happens to our buying power when we want to buy from foreign countries? It goes down. See, now foreign products become more expensive to us. And that leads to a lower standard of living for the average American. It also could lead to a big unemployment problems. Because if the dollar now is worth less relative to other currencies, with our buying power goes down, we buy less. We buy less from them, they buy less from us. You know, demand goes down, and we get more unemployment. Anyway, I think all economists, well, I shouldn't say all, but certainly most economists believe that that is inevitable. It's already occurring. The dollar is already falling down from its perch as a standard currency, and we are already beginning to feel the brunt, the ill effects of this. And of course, it's always the average American, average income American, that feels the pain the most. Okay, what is the gold standard? An arrangement whereby the currencies of most countries are convertible into gold at a fixed rate. So this is not what we're on. See, we're on what's called a freely flexible international exchange rate system, or a managed float system. But there was a time in the past, leading up to World War I especially, that was the heyday of the gold standard, where countries used gold to trade amongst one another. And the values of their currencies were pegged to gold. Now, this took place especially after World War II, or actually in 1943 in Bretton Woods. See, what was one advance of the gold standard? Any increase in money supply would be limited by a country's gold holdings. Now, here's a very important point. What is the danger of being off the gold standard, or a danger in a freely flexible international exchange rate system? Well, the danger, see, if we were on the gold standard, what is the only way that we could increase the money supply?
Produce more gold.
More gold, exactly. Now, if we're not on the gold standard, meaning that, okay, now nothing backs up our money, it's what is called a fiat currency. A fiat currency is a currency that nothing metallic backs up. Okay, what is the danger, the potential danger of having a fiat currency? Yeah, exactly. You could print as much money as you want. Now, here's the point. If we had a rule that said that we could only increase the money supply as much as we increase GDP, for example, you know, let's say that GDP increases by 3%. So we say, okay, because GDP is increased by 3%, we can increase the money supply by 3%. Next year, GDP increases by, let's say, 5%. So we say, okay, we can increase the money supply by 5%. If we had a rule like this and we increase the money supply only in relation to growth, would it make any difference if we were on the gold standard or a freely flexible system?
Wouldn't it be harder to get rich then? I mean, because you're limited to a set amount of...
Well, yeah, that's a good point. Let me finish my train of thought and I'll get to that. That's actually an interesting point you bring up. But see, if we had a rule that said that we only could increase the money supply as much as GDP, then it would make no difference if we were on the gold standard or on the fiat system. But what is the potential danger of being on the fiat system? See, the potential danger is that a country could greatly increase the supply of money for political reasons because there's no constraint on that country. See, with the gold standard, there's constraint. Oh, we can't increase the money supply unless we increase our gold holdings. But with the fiat system, well, if we've got political reasons to increase the money supply, we can do that. You see? And, of course, the potential danger there is either to bring about more inflation. Now, this is the first time I've ever said this sentence in this class because it's a new phenomena. But it's becoming clear more and more that by quantitative easing and the greatly increase in the money supply could actually cause deflation. Now, we're going to talk about this more later, but either way, either more inflation or more deflation, then bad things happen. All right? Now, let me bring up the point that you made. The point was, can I kind of repeat that?
Wouldn't it be harder for you to get rich?
Yeah, wouldn't it be harder for you to get rich on the gold standard? And he makes a very good point there, see, because if things are very stable, you know, let's say we have a very steady rate of growth, you know, 2%, 3% every year, year after year. Well, in a way, that would be good for the economy. But if you're talking about getting rich, then that would not be a good thing because how do you get rich? At least in the speculative market. Well, you take advantage of wide swings in the market, right? Like how do you make money in the stock market? Well, you buy low and you sell high. But if stock prices aren't changing very much, well, you don't have much opportunity to make much money, right? I mean, if stock prices just increased at 2% year after year, there wouldn't be very much chance of making money. But if the stock prices are widely going up and down, you got these huge swings, you got these big booms and then these big busts. Well, for the few, and it is a few, for the few, there's actually more opportunities here. Because if you really know what you're doing and, you know, combine that with a little bit of luck maybe, you know, you can take advantage of those wide swings and you can be, if you time it right, you could become, you know, very wealthy. Yeah.
Is this wild swing due to the fact that there's already gold in the market?
See, we're not on the gold standard. Gold is just another metal. See, there's nothing special about gold. I mean, it has value because it's useful and relatively scarce. Same as silver has value, or that door has value. You know, I mean, so gold doesn't carry any special weight.
No, what I mean is, so let's say the price for an ounce of gold right now is $1,400.
Yeah.
But then that drops because there's more gold in the market now. Would that decrease the value of the gold that's already in the
Yeah, because the value of gold does fluctuate according to, you know, market forces. Now, what's one reason why people demand gold? Well, one reason why people demand gold is that gold is a metal of refuge. In other words, when people demand gold are usually times when things are uncertain. When people expect bad things to happen, then they will take refuge in buying more gold. And when they become more optimistic about the future, then they will sell gold and get into other activities that will hopefully bring about a higher return. So that's, you know, one thing about gold and silver that influences the price variation. Anyway, it's an interesting concept there about you know, taking advantage of the wide, you know, the wide swings. What did America honor gold payments after World War I? Yes, if countries demanded payment for goods and services in gold, we would pay them in gold. See, that was part of the gold system. What happened to this practice of paying in gold? During the Depression of the 30s, foreigners demanded payment in gold, thus depleting our gold supply. See, the Depression of 1930 started here and then spread to the rest of the world. And there was a time when other countries were saying, well, we've got a bunch of gold over there in America, and look, they're having some big problems, so we better get our gold out while we can. And the American government looked at this as being a threat to our economy, so they took action to encourage foreigners not to take their gold out of the country. And how did we do that? Because I have talked about this before.
Made interest higher.
Exactly. We made, yeah, very good, very good. We made interest higher. We increased interest rates, and then people who had gold here were making more interest on that gold, and so that was an incentive for them to keep their gold here instead of taking it out of the country. Now, how did we increase interest rates? Over there in Dublin, how do we increase interest rates? How does the Federal Reserve, say, there's only two interest rates the Federal Reserve actually controls. That's the federal funds rate and the discount rate. And all other interest rates are determined by market forces of demand and supply. So what can the Federal Reserve do to influence those market forces? Well, it can low, like, for example, if it okay, yeah, thanks for telling me. Yeah, he told me he had to leave early, and I appreciate that. What happens, what happened in the 30s is that the Federal Reserve decreased the money supply. A decrease of the money supply increased interest rates. See, when you decrease the supply of something, everything else being equal, then the value goes up. Did I just say that right? Yeah, value goes up. We increase interest rates. But, of course, that caused more unemployment because if the problem in the 30s was insufficient demand and you take action to lower demand, then that is something that made matters worse instead of better. But the reason, what we're talking about here, so we're not really talking about the Depression of the 30s. What we're talking about is the gold standard and the current value of countries' currencies. So by decreasing the money supply, we increased interest rates, and that did encourage foreigners to keep more of the gold in the country. The gold standard, the pure gold standard, ended during World War I. The gold standard collapsed, limiting trade during the 20s and 30s. But there was a semblance of the gold standard that really persisted until 1972. But we'll talk about that here in just a little bit. What is the fixed exchange rate system? The value of each currency was pegged to an ounce of gold. What happened after the 30s, and then like especially after at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, starting in 1944, we embarked on what is called a fixed international exchange rate system. Now, this was not a gold system, per se, in terms of promising to pay one another in gold. But what it was is it used gold as a standard by each country pegging their currency to gold. See, this was between 45 and 72. So in other words, the United States said, well, it would take $35 to buy an ounce of gold. And the English said, well, it would take, you know, so many pounds to buy an ounce of gold. And the German said, well, it takes so many marks to buy an ounce of gold. Now, this was before euros, so that's why I'm using the term marks when we talk about the German currency. And the French currency was called the franc before it accepted the euro as its currency. So the French said, well, it would take so many francs to buy an ounce of gold. Now, here in theory, if everyone knows the value of their currencies relative to gold, you know, relative to an ounce of gold, then by the same token, we know the value of our currencies relative to one another. And when we know the value of our currencies relative to one another, then this facilitates international trade. Now, see how that works? We got gold here. We all peg our currency to gold. Therefore, we know what our values are worth relative to one another, and therefore, it's easier to trade amongst one another. Now, that system worked very well until the 1970s. Now, what are the 70s? What's the decade of the 70s characterized by? Anybody know that? The 70s is characterized by inflation. Okay? Unemployment as well, but we're going to concentrate here on the inflation problems. The average annual inflation rate during the 70s was 10% annually. Now, at a 10% inflation rate annually, year after year, how long will it take prices to double? Well, the rule of 72 says you take 10 divided into 72 is about 7. So with a 10% inflation rate, every 7 years, prices will double. Now, that's what was happening during the 1970s in the United States. Now, here is where the problem comes in. The problem is not just inflation amongst, you know, in different countries. The problem is that these different countries were experiencing different rates of inflation in the early 70s. You know, America, 10%. England, maybe 14%. Germany, maybe 6%. Now, when a country experiences, like, take America, for example. If America experiences a 10% inflation rate, what happens to the value of our currency? And it drops by 10%. All right, England is experiencing a 14% inflation rate. What happens to the value of its currency?
The decrease.
By
14%.
And Germany is experiencing a 6% inflation rate. So what happens to the value of the mark?
It decreases by
6%. By 6%. Now, if in reality the values of our currencies are changing relative to one another, can we trade assuming that the values are fixed relative to one another? You see the problem? See, it defies reality. I mean, we can't trade amongst one another. I mean, if everyone here represented different countries, how can we trade amongst one another, assuming that our currencies are fixed relative to one another, but in reality, they're greatly changing in value relative to one another? See, and after a little time, well, that system becomes unworkable. I mean, you know, it's too devoid from reality. So what did we do? Well, what we did is we said, well, this problem is bigger than we are. The only thing we can do is simply give up and let the market determine the value of our currencies. You know, we're not going to peg our currencies to gold any longer. We're just simply going to let, you know, the forces of demand and supply determine the values, and whatever happens, happens. Now, in theory, that's what we did, but in actuality, you know, we entered into what is called a managed float system, you know, rather than a pure float system. But that was the reason for leaving this Bretton Woods system in 1972. See, what was the Bretton Woods agreement? All foreign exchange rates were fixed in terms of the dollar, and the dollar could be converted to gold at a fixed exchange rate. But like I say, the system became unworkable in the early 70s. Under Bretton Woods, you know, dollar was worth $35 an ounce. When was Bretton Woods agreement? 1944, just before the end of World War II. What is a currency devaluation? An increase in the official peg price of foreign exchange in terms of the domestic currency. So in other words, we say that a currency has been devalued, of its value goes down relative to other currencies. We say that it's revalued if the value goes up relative to other currencies. So those are just vocabulary words. What is International Monetary Fund? Helps facilitate exchange rates by allowing countries to trade currencies. Virtually all the major countries in the world help support financially the IMF. And the IMF under this PEG system, under our present system, serves a purpose. And one of the purposes of the IMF is to help countries influence the value of their currencies. You know, for example, let's say we want the value of the dollar to go down on the world market. So we can go to the IMF and we can borrow dollars. And then we take those dollars and we exchange those dollars around the world for other currencies. Therefore, the dollar increases in value, increases in volume, which decreases the value, and other currencies go up in value because the supply of those currencies are going down. So we take dollars, we exchange for other currencies, and we go back to the IMF and we pay back our loan with these other currencies. All right? So this is an example of how countries can use the IMF to influence those market forces for their currencies. Usually they would want the value of the currency to go down. I don't know of any, you know, I can't think of any example where a country would take action to increase the value of their currencies. Countries always want to devalue the value of their currencies. Okay, let's see. And this is what I just explained. I'm kind of rushing through these because I'm trying to get done here. What was the advantage of the fixed rate system? I've already explained this. Inflation of the 70s, I explained that. What year did the Bretton Woods system collapse? 1972. We uncoupled the dollar from the pegged international monetary system. All right, now, the gold standard was greatly weakened, and the true gold standard came to an end during World War I. But we kind of limped along on sort of a modified gold system. But in 1972, the final nail was nailed in the coffin of the gold system. And in 1972, under President Richard Nixon, we said that we would no longer honor payment of in gold, or that we would no longer. I mean, if foreign countries brought their dollars to us, we're not going to guarantee that we're going to pay in gold. And so it completely broke the tie. 1972 was the year that completely broke the tie between our monetary system and gold. Okay, well, now this is something, what should a country specialize in? Because of that video that we saw, I actually talked about this, about comparative advantage and absolute advantage. Absolute advantage means that you can do something better than anyone else. Comparative advantage says you can do something with lower opportunity costs than everyone else. And I just explained earlier that countries trade based on comparative advantage. See, not absolute advantage. See, got about 88 of these slides, so I've got ways to go yet. What should a country produce? It should produce those things in which it has a comparative advantage, meaning low opportunity costs. And with your baskets, I already talked about that, and I'm not going to talk about that. What are the three reasons for international specialization? Differences in resources, economies of scale, differences in taste. In other words, this just says that, hey, the world is a big place and all countries are different. Therefore, all countries have a comparative advantage in something. And that's how they determine what to trade amongst one another. And this, I've already talked about this. I didn't really. When the world price is greater than our price, we will export. See, when the world, we produce widgets. Foreigners produce widgets, but when our price is greater than that foreign price, then we will export. If it's less, we will import. And if it's equal, then it really makes no difference. When would a high wage worker be cheaper than a low wage worker? Okay, here. Here's a very interesting concept. Let's say that you can pay an American worker $25 an hour to do a certain job, or pay a Mexican worker $5 an hour to do the same job. Now, which is cheaper? Well, now, you'd think that, you're paying a Mexican worker $5, so that's cheaper. But that's not necessarily true. How could the $25 paid to the American worker be cheaper than the $5 being paid to the Mexican worker? And therefore, that's the point. See, production, that's exactly the point. See, there's inputs and there's outputs. The input, the $5 an hour is an input, but what is the output? Right? Because what's really important here is that, for example, let's say we pay an American worker $25 an hour, but the American worker can produce something in an hour that has a market value of $100. So we pay him $1, and for every $1 we pay him, we get $4 back. Now, let's say the Mexican worker, we pay $5 an hour, But he can only make something in an hour that has a market value of, let's say, $10. So for the Mexican worker, for every dollar we pay him, we get $2 back. Now, would you rather pay a worker $1 and get $4 back, or pay a worker $1 and get $2 back? You see what I mean? So sometime the, it's just not how much you pay someone in terms of wage, because it's how much that someone can produce. How productive is that someone? Now, because of America is a very advanced industrial country, a highly capitalized country, we have an advantage, despite our high wages, it's usually better to produce here in this country because our productivity is so high. Now, in what area would we maybe want to go to a foreign, produce in a foreign country? Well, we would want to go to a foreign country in areas that are labor intensive. See, capital intensive industries would stay in America. Labor intensive industries may go to a foreign country to take advantage of the low foreign wages. So it depends if you're capital intensive, that means that a lot of what you do is tied up with machines, with capital. If you're a labor intensive industry, that says, well, most of what you do is just raw labor. All right? So which companies can take advantage of low foreign wages? Those companies that are involved in a labor intensive industry, like sewing, like the textile industry is labor intensive. That's why so many of our textiles are made in countries where the wages are very low. But in terms of electronics, you don't go to a low wage country, you go to a country that's highly industrialized, like the United States or like Europe or Japan or China. Okay, so what makes one worker more productive than another worker in like another country? Well, infrastructure. See, in other words, infrastructure is a road system, a communication system. Capital, of course, are machines and tools. Education, of course, is, high level of education or not. Skills tied with education, or work attitudes can change from one country to another. So, these are things that may make one country more productive than another country. Why have trade restrictions? There are good and bad reasons for trade restrictions. And how do we restrict trade? Through tariffs, import quotas, export subsidies, licensing agreements, unreasonable standards. So the rest of this chapter really talks about, all economists agree that free trade would be best for countries, especially over the long run. But yet not one country in the world operates on a totally free trade basis. All countries restrict trade in one form or another. So what I don't have time to get into it, and you can read it, from the chapter, because I'm just not going to be able to. But there are good reasons for trade restrictions, and there are bad reasons for trade restrictions. So read in the book about, when trade restrictions would be good, but then when trade restrictions, could cause more harm than good. And that essentially will end the chapter. Anyway, it is time to go, and I don't want to keep you. So what are y'all going to do for next time? Read chapter 11, right, on business cycles. So I'll see you all next time.